And the first question is from Edward Sterck from BMO Capital Markets. Please go ahead.
Good morning. So I've got just starting off with NuChem and the SWU sales for the period. They're not disclosed in the MD&A. Is it reasonable to assume that the conversion that is disclosed is factored into the the UF6 sales that are disclosed is actually EUP, and that the enrichment is actually included within that?
Oh, Edward, I'll ask Ken Seitz to answer that.
Yeah, I'm going to have to get back to you on that one. I don't think that that's the case, but we'll have to. I don't have that at my fingertips.
Okay, no worries. And then just a follow-up question again on NuChem. With the sort of incoming cash flow of around $99 million for the quarter, is there quite a lot of seasonality in the cash flow profile of NuChem? I.e., would we expect lower cash flow in subsequent quarters?
There is similar seasonality to our own portfolio, and it's the same 6-month delivery notice that they have under their contracts. Are very similar. That's sort of an industry standard, and so they could, in any given year, have similar lumpiness to exactly like we're experiencing in the quarter at the moment.
Yeah. In addition, Ed, it's Grant Isaac here. Keep in mind that that cash flow is largely due to a drawdown of inventory as well as the accounts receivable in that quarter. So just reinforcing that, it can be lumpy.
Okay. Marvelous. Thank you.
Thanks, Ed.
Thank you. The next question is from Tyler Langdon from J.P. Morgan. Please go ahead.
Yeah, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my question. Just regarding the draft safety guidelines from the NRA, just wonder if you could share your sort of thoughts on that, sort of if it was in line with your expectations.
So, Tyler, we have had a look at them, and I would say they're stringent, as we would have expected them to be. We know from talking to our Japanese customers and the utilities that they know them inside and out, and I think are commenting on the draft part of them. But I think you can expect that they'll look fairly similar when they do come out. So, I think they are fairly stringent. One of the pieces that might not be as widely known is that utilities, we believe, and we've heard, will have several years to comply with the guidelines, to conform with the guidelines when they are published finally, which we believe will happen in July. So we have had a look at them. They're available to anyone. We're certainly not reactor experts in that regard, but as I say, our Japanese customers and the utilities have looked through them. We've talked to them about it, and they're spending, I would say, billions of dollars today to comply with those guidelines.
Then in terms of, I guess, restarts, do you think, sort of given that you said they're more stringent, I think you last quarter you thought maybe you could see 6 to 8 restarts this year. Do you think there's a chance that it pushes back that number this year?
Yeah, we did put those numbers out, and we've been holding somewhere around there, I guess not knowing exactly. But I think, Ken, there was some news came out of Japan this morning.
Yeah, absolutely, Tim. So we saw the heads of 3 large Japanese utilities talk about their own applications for restart. That was Kansai, Kyushu, and Shikoku. That they will be submitting their applications in the middle of July, and that there's a good chance that at least those units will be on the grid within 2013. And so there's 5 units there, and we expect a couple other utilities to be submitting their applications as well. So 6 to 8, certainly uncertainty around those numbers, but there hasn't been a material fact change in our view since we last put out those numbers, and certainly some announcements coming from some of the utilities that would in some way support those numbers.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Tyler.
Thank you. Our next question is from Greg Barnes from TD Securities. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I guess there's a question for Ken or for Tim. The guidance for sales volume for NuChem of 9 to 11 million pounds this year, I assume that includes the sell down of the remaining HEU that they have?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does, Greg.
How much?
Well, it's it's sort of similar to our own situation in that if you are designating HEU pounds for sale or other inventories that you might have, it's possible they carry a little bit of HEU into next year, but the bulk of it will be sold in this year and under that 9 to 11 million pounds.
So how do you think their sales volume to translate into 2014 then without HEU, or the bulk of HEU anyway?
Yeah, we, if you look at historically what New Chem has done, they've been in that sort of 3,000 to 5,000 ton range, and that was prior to HEU and all those things. And so depending on the liquidity in the spot market and the opportunities that make themselves available, we could see them doing that sort of volume in the future.
Okay, okay. A bigger picture question on Urenco, which seems creating a lot of buzz. Any comments on what's going on with the sales process, timing, your level of interest, anything?
Yeah, Greg, I don't think we have any better information than anyone else or what's been put out into the public. We're watching, like others, as to who might be selling, what percentage they might be selling. You know, we've had an interest in enrichment for some years, evidenced by our investment in GLE, and so, you know, we're just watching the Urenco piece and nothing further to report. We'll be interested to see if they can ever reach agreement on what's for sale and when.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Our next question is from Rod Nickel from Reuters. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Just to follow up on the question about Urenco, I was wondering, Tim, if you can elaborate a bit at where Cameco's at on whether it would make a decision to bid for a stake and whether one of the options under consideration is a joint bid with Canada Pension Plan.
Yeah, we wouldn't comment on any of those things. I think, as I said, we're just watching. I'm not sure anyone knows what's for sale or when, and so we have our interest in GLE that we're certainly continuing to pursue, which we hope will get us into the enrichment business. But on the Urenco side, we're just watching.
Do you have any sense of what the timeline might be for whoever ends up buying up Urenco, when that might happen?
Well, when you have three different governments and countries involved, I can't imagine it'll be very quick. But, you know, we just watch the public information that comes out. And so we really don't, Rod, have any better information than anyone else.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Our next question is from John Tumazos, from John Tumazos Very Independent Research. Please go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call, my question. My question involves two aspects of uranium market pricing, which I'd appreciate if you could try to explain to me, if you understand them yourselves. As the Russians stop selling these pounds, do you expect an immediate impact, or do you think there's consumer, transit, other inventories that would absorb the blow for a period of time? And secondly, as substitute fuel prices change, such as the U.S. net gas price rebounding from 190 to 440, does that affect the uranium price in terms of motivating plant restarts, for example, in the U.S.?
I'll ask Ken to speak to that. Ken?
Yes, absolutely. So with respect to the first question, the HEU agreement ending and the Russian material stopping its flow to the West, you know, we've talked about our level of commitments for some period of time, and that is that we're heavily committed through 2016. And we wouldn't be the only producer that's committed that way. And similarly, our customers are fairly well covered through that period. We've talked about it in the past. And I think it just helps to explain that while HEU is coming off, the end of it's not going to be a colossal event, and that utilities and producers have been planning for it for some time. So we expect the transition to be fairly smooth, and with things like Cigar Lake coming on, it helps to fill that gap. I will say, that, of course, that the end of the HEU agreement shines a light on this transition our market is going through, and that is from secondary supply dominated to really mine supply. And so I think it just shines a light on the need for more primary production. So, you know, I think with respect to HU, that will be the sort of transition. With respect to natural gas prices, you know, we've watched that very closely. And for the longer term, we, you know, obviously competing with other energy power generation sources. But I'll say that the bulk of the development that we see in the nuclear industry today is in places like China, India, Korea, South Korea, and Russia, who talk more about energy security and energy independence, and frankly, clean air, then you know, the need for the diverse mix, then beholden to natural gas prices. So we do have some new build construction in some regulated markets in the U.S., but we don't think that this this fluctuation in natural gas prices necessarily has a big impact on the future of new build.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Once again, if you have a question, please press star one at this time. And the next question is from Borden Putnam from Meoni Capital. Please go ahead.
Hey, good morning, Tim. Might be a question for Bob here. On Cigar Lake, you report that the first jet boring was a successful test. But in the April 3rd hearings at the CNSC, Steve Lowen, I believe, reported that those were merely the drilling of the 16-inch holes and that no cavitation had been done yet. Can you update us on when you will do cavitation and what level of the mine this test work's being done at?
Yeah. Thanks, Borden. Appreciate the question. In fact, Bob and I were meeting with the Cigar Lake people just yesterday, so Bob can give you an update on that.
Yeah, Borden, that information from the hearing is correct. What we have been testing and done multiple holes with the one of the jet boring machines has been all of the cycling of drilling, checking out the packers, the backflow preventers, and so on, up to, and we have not done jetting. So we haven't jetted cavities. We've drilled up through to the length and tested all the various features of the machine, so the operators are very adept at running it through its paces, changing out steel, getting the cycle time, relocating, changing the direction of the drills, and so on. And all of this has been done in the mine in a production, what will one day be a production crosscut. So it's all down on the 480 level is where it's happening. We anticipate doing jetting in rock with having the high pressure water systems and so on in place to start cutting rock with the jet system in probably June, July time.
Oh, interesting. Thanks, Bob. One final follow-up, I should say. The backfilling with concrete will be done from the same level as the mining, if you will, from below the ore body. Without bogging down the conversation here, can you walk us through the mechanics of that? It's got to be quite fascinating.
Yeah, it's after the hole is complete, then all the jet boring tools and everything are extracted from the hole, and then there's a pipe arrangement that is inserted up to the top of the cavity. Included in that is a breather pipe that allows the air to get out, and then we start injecting, pumping concrete up through the concrete pipe. The air is allowed to escape back through a vent pipe down, and you just keep pumping in concrete until you've filled it right up to the top, and concrete comes out the bottom, and you withdraw and seal it off and let it harden.
Interesting. Well, I'll look forward to another update. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Bort.
Our next question is from Oscar Cabrera from Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Please go ahead.
Thanks, operator. Good afternoon, everyone. I just wanted to get back into, I can appreciate that in the current environment, being mindful of capital expenditures and that is important. But, going back to Greg's question in terms of your angle, if you had a dollar to spend over the next 5 years, would you put that in enrichment or on your primary uranium mine?
Well, Oscar, we are investing in our uranium mines. Obviously, Cigar Lake, we're bringing that on this year. We've got, MacArthur River, the Brownfield project. So those are our first choice. Where we are already, safe jurisdictions, we know the government, we know the people, the Aboriginals, have the infrastructure. That's our first choice, and that's where we've been focusing.
Okay, no, great. That helps. And then with respect to Bruce Power, in the current environment, can you remind me, when do you have to reach a decision whether you like to, extend the lease on the reactors and what the investment for the retrofitting of those reactors, the capital expenditure amount that you will need to do? When do you need to reach a decision, and what's the level of capex for that, please?
Yeah, Oscar, that's a good question because there was some movement in the quarter on that. If you probably will have seen that our Duncan Hawthorne, the present CEO at Bruce, negotiated with the Ontario government the extension of the floor price protection for the Bruce B units to now match the lifetime of the reactors. So it gave us some additional life, if you like, to those reactors. So I think those floor protections were starting to come off at the end of 2015 for the first one and then going through the rest of the decade. And now they're, I think they're matched up with the lifetime of the reactors, which is more the 2019-2020 period. So it's around that period now that we'll have to take decisions on refurbishment. Of course, that's not; those aren't taken in isolation. Those are taken in consultation with the Ontario Power Authority and with the Ontario government, just to, as to what the requirements are going forward. So some big capital, and of course those will be large capital decisions, but toward the end of the decade, we're looking at that investment now, and we'll, as we did with the Bruce A units, we'll look at the economics of those decisions and decide whether it's right for Cameco.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Our next question is from Daniel Rohr of Morningstar. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. Just a question regarding long-term demand, specifically China's rather ambitious growth plans for its reactor fleet. Do you all get the sense from talking with Chinese officials that the government's resolve to meet those big objectives for growth has it been in any way bolstered by the high-profile pollution issues we've seen so far this year?
Yeah, you know, we're in constant contact with the two big Chinese customers. We signed some very large agreements with them back in 2010 and have just recently got the Chinese Canadian Nuclear Cooperation Agreement in place, so we count China as being a major customer for us going forward. You know, it depends whose numbers you're looking at. We've seen quite varying predictions of growth in China going forward. There, whosoever you look at, they're pretty aggressive. When you see today 28 reactors under construction, that's a lot. I think we see about 58 or 60 gigawatt installed by the end of the decade and continuing to grow after that. And so that is aggressive growth. You know, do climate change, clean air, more importantly, issues factor in for them? Absolutely, they do. They get to CNN just like everyone else does, and you can see the streets of Beijing some days where, you know, you can't see across the street. So that's clearly a factor they weigh in. The other factor, of course, is just the burgeoning demand for electricity, and it's not going to be just on the back of nuclear. I can tell you nuclear, even with that growth plan, represents just a small fraction of the power and electricity they're going to need going forward. So they're going to be pulling on all of the levers.
Thanks much.
Thank you.
Our next question is from Edward Sturck of BMO Capital Markets. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. Just coming back for a couple more questions here. The first is on going back to NuChem, actually, and the question of SWU. In the guidance that's provided for NuChem going forwards, it's indicated that 500,000 kilograms SWU will be sold during 2013. Apart from this quarter where it's not disclosed in the sales figures, will we get an indication of what the quarterly enrichment sales are?
We can certainly get you those numbers, Ed. Okay,
thank you. And then the second question really is just on the royalties in Saskatchewan. It looks as though they've come down a bit further than I'd been initially anticipating. Are some of the costs that can be offset against them being brought in sooner than expected?
So, and I'd just say overall we're happy to see the movement by the provincial government. We think it'll be a good incentive for growth going forward. But Grant Isaac has some details on that.
Yeah, the framework that you're referring to, Ed, and then actually you put a note out on, still remains accurate. The legislative framework in March did speak to the profit-based system, so that's a transition going to the two tiers with a price trigger at $22 a kilogram. So that framework hasn't changed. The piece that we're just still a bit uncertain about, and it's why we haven't, why we don't have disclosure on what the benefits will look like, is that, you know, the legislative change has to be given life by regulatory standards, and the process we're in now in the province of Saskatchewan is to develop those regulations. Those regulations will, in fact, govern the transition plan to the new structure from the old, and it will also codify those costs that you were talking about. What I would say in general, though, is we're very pleased that a broader range of costs will now be included in the royalty structure than had previously been included. So in addition to it being a profit-based system and actual and at time of spend, we also see a broader range as well supporting not just the direct expenditures that are required by Cameco, but also some of the infrastructure investment that's required just to be doing economic activity in that part of the world. So more to come as we understand the regulations and the transition on this.
Excellent, thank you. So would it be fair, just in the current quarter then, the one just passed, to assume that a greater percentage of the sales for the quarter came from lower royalty jurisdictions than perhaps would be normal?
Yeah, it's probably more fair to say that the transition plan for 2013 will basically keep the province whole for this year. So really there would have been no marginal difference between the old system and the new system for the first quarter. So that's what you're detecting. That's still the effect of the old system.
Okay, that's fantastic. Thank you.
Thanks, Ed.
Once again, if you have a question, please press star 1 at this time. And our next question is from Greg Barnes of TD Securities. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. I want to go back to the question about China reactor growth. And where do you think they stand in relation to building inventory? Where are they buying the future supply of uranium from? I hope, or I'd assume you anticipate signing some additional longer-term agreements with them. Do you want to give us some color around that?
Yeah, thanks, Greg. I'll ask Ken to comment on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks, Greg. As you know, I'm sure that the Chinese have been very active, obviously, over the last 5 years, contracting uranium in anticipation of this very, very large new build program that they have underway. And it's true that Fukushima, you know, put a pause on that. So that I would say today, the Chinese are fairly well covered. We put them in the camp of other utilities where buying is somewhat discretionary among the Chinese. I think what's often lost, though, is with that large new build program, inventory policy is a question, and anywhere from 3 to 4 years of inventory needs to be put behind all of these new reactors. And of course, initial cores are 1.5 times the volume of reloads, and so on and so forth. So while the Chinese have a lot of inventory, it could have be well covered at the moment. They need that for this very large program. The Chinese are in the market buying today. We have sold uranium to the Chinese certainly over the last 6 months, and we're in those discussions all the time. In terms of new long-term supply, Greg, not surprising, we're spending a lot of time in Beijing these days, and we absolutely expect that the Chinese are today, and frankly, and will continue to be a very important customer of ours. And it's all augmented by, as Tim mentioned earlier, the recently signed nuclear cooperation agreement between Canada and China, and we'll now be sending Canadian material as well. So, yes, China is a big part of our plans.
So, Ken, when you say they're fairly well covered in relation to what other utilities have done, do you suggest then that they're covered through 2016 like everyone else, and then their requirements widen out again?
It's a really difficult one to answer, Greg, in that, again, it becomes a question of inventory policy and what it is that they want to have sitting behind their reactors. When I say 3 to 4 years, that's been our experience with Asian utilities. But of course, with Chinese and energy security and really no domestic uranium production, it could be that they want to have larger inventories than that. So I find it difficult to give you a year, 2015, 2016. All I can tell you is they're in the market today, and I can also tell you that we're talking to them all the time about new long-term supply.
Good. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you, Greg.
Our next question is from Andrew O'Neill of Central Securities. Please go ahead.
Thank you. In your MD&A, you mentioned that there's still, even though there's been some pushing out and cancellation of new primary supply in the future, that there are still some projects going ahead, particularly linked with sovereign interests. I wonder if you could be a little more specific about which particular interests and projects those are, and what you really think is motivating them, you know, I guess, ignoring these market price signals.
Yeah, I think the ones we would probably refer you to are you know, the Kazakhs, who we saw some reports come out from some government member that, you know, they plan to increase their production through 2016, I think from 21 by about 4,000 ton, I think, from 21 to 25,000 ton. So they, you know, they continue to move it up. That said, we expected that, and certainly in our calculations have factored that in. I guess the other piece would be the Chinese announcement on the Husab project in Namibia. Now, I can't say I have any firsthand information on how that's going ahead, or we saw some pretty aggressive, at least from our point of view, pretty aggressive timelines on bringing that project on. Won't be a simple project, and you know, we've had looks at it in the past, and it's not an easy project. But those would be the two pieces I think we were referring to.
And what do you think is motivating, you know, those efforts on both of those situations, I guess?
Well, I think from the Chinese side, clearly a strategy to not only purchase uranium from suppliers like us, as Ken was talking about, but to have some domestic production. They have very little, but as much as they can get out of China. And then, you know, we've seen them go into Niger with a small project, and now this one in Namibia. So I think, you know, they're looking to source some of their own production and have a multi-pronged strategy of produce at home, produce a bit abroad, and then buy.
I see. And Kazakhstan, I'm sorry?
Well, Kazakhstan, I think that would just be incremental production to what they've got, probably ramping up the existing facilities to their design capacity, as we've done. It's taken us some time to do that, to get to the 2,000-ton level that our design capacity is at. It's taken us several years to do that. We're at that now, and we're happy about that, but I would assume that's what they're doing with some of the other projects, because we don't hear greenfield projects. It's more incremental production on existing projects.
And just if I can follow up, just does that suggest that generally in Kazakhstan they're not as much value maximizers as they might perhaps be if they were more of a commercial business?
Well, I think they are. You know, we've seen we've been working with them now for over 15 years, and certainly seen the progress. They're very astute, very aware of the market. We see them, you know, in the United States market, in the European markets. So I think they're quite astute. As I say, I think it's just incremental production that can that they can add to their existing production.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our next question is from Emily Meredith of Energy Intelligence. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking the time. Just a quick question on imports into China, your shipments into China. How is the current pause in uranium import licensing on their part affecting you all, if at all?
Yeah, Ken has some recent information on that.
Mm.
Thanks.
Right. Yeah, so, you know, we're shipping, physically delivering uranium to China from several places in the world right now, and as you rightly point out, there's a little bit of a hiatus on that as they work through some environmental permitting issues. We expect those issues to be cleared up over the next month or month and a half, and that uranium will again once again be crossing the border into China. So how does it affect our deliveries for the year? Today, as we see it, we expect to make all of our deliveries to China, so that while there might be a slight timing issue within the year, depending on how those approvals border crossings advance. The timing issue, just with respect to quarterly deliveries, we expect to make them all within the year.
Okay. And will you realize the revenues for those deliveries when you expect to, or when the deliveries are made?
We will realize the revenue from those when we're paid for them, which is dependent, of course, on when they get delivered. But again, we expect to do that within the year.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
Our next question is from Borden Putnam of Mioni Capital. Please go ahead.
Bob, another question if I can. I'm going to take you back a couple of months. I didn't cue myself up at the last conference call. Well, first of all, the 43-101 on MacArthur River is a stunning piece of work. I I read that a couple of times, actually, and looking at the engineering that you guys have been inventive on and so carefully put in place with the freeze walls there, it's just, it's a remarkable thing, and there's nobody else in the world doing it like this, so just props to you guys. It's quite impressive. And that leads to my question on the MacArthur reserves. There was a staggering increase to the probable announced, but it's about 80% increase to the probable at MacArthur, some 58 million pounds nearly. You haven't done anything that material since 2001 in probable, and I wonder if you could, I'm guessing that's from a mine plan put around indicated. Can you give us a little color on that and where those pounds are located and what your plan for those is as far as moving them into proven?
Yeah, Borden, yeah, that's the big piece there is the B-zone pod in to the north. That's what was a big change in the and triggered frankly that technical report that to bring those in as well as some other reserves in within the mine. That was the big change.
Okay, and last question for me. I haven't been up to site for a while. The Phoenix resource is growing. It's an indicated, which is a pretty high level of confidence for resource, and its grade went down year on year, but its tonnage almost doubled. Can you point me in the direction of where it is and how many drill holes are in it and what kind of attention you're putting to it this year? Thanks.
The Phoenix deposit is north of Key Lake and south of MacArthur River. It's a little bit south of our Millennium deposit. It's operated by Denison, so Denison is, you need to go to the Denison reports to get the information on holes and their plans and where they are. We're a minority shareholder in it, but Denison is the operator.
Okay, thanks. So what's your plans for it this year? I guess I'll just look at their stuff.
I think they have a program in place. Yeah, we have to check it. Borden, I would say we appreciate your comments with respect to MacArthur River and the work that's been done there, and we look around the table here to try and take credit for it, and we can't find anyone that can take credit for it because it's those guys at the site underground that have really done a great job of finding solutions. You'll remember if you've been on these calls for a few years, some of the issues we were dealing with trying to drill up into the sandstone, those 100-meter upholes to freeze, and they have done a very good job of being inventive, finding solutions, and that MacArthur mine just keeps getting better for us. So we will pass your comments on to them.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. I went compared the old 43-101s to the new one, and the change in your approach is just dramatic. It's just very well done.
We'll pass that on to the people at site.
Thank you. This will conclude the questions from the telephone lines. I would like to turn the meeting back over to Mr. Tim Gitzel for closing remarks.
Thank you, operator, and thank you to everyone who's joined us on the call today. In closing, I'd just like to reiterate that we continue to prepare for the long-term demand we foresee in the market, but we also recognize the importance of adapting to the current environment to remain competitive and to return value to our shareholders in the near term. And that's the path you see us following today. We've built upon our existing foundation of strong production and industry expertise to intensify our focus on execution and maximize efficiencies while also pursuing growth measured to the conditions of the market. As a result, I believe we will continue to deliver strong results and remain a leader in our field. So again, thanks for joining us and have a great day.